ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय
Reading this morning from Canto 4, Chapter 25, Text 38.
Kam no tvad anyam ramaye
Yarati gyam akovidam
Asamparaya vimokam
Ashva-santa-vidam-pashum
Kamdo-trad-anyam-ramaye Yarati-gyam-akovidam Asamparaya-bhimukham Ashvastana vidham pashum
Come
unto whom?
No.
Then.
Tvat.
Then you. Anyam. Other. Ramaye.
I shall allow to enjoy.
He. Certainly. Arati, gyam, without knowledge of sex enjoyment. Akovidam,
therefore almost foolish.
Asamparaya, without knowledge of the next life.
Avimukham,
looking forward.
Ashvastana vidam,
one who does not know
what is happening next.
Pashum,
like animals.
Translation, how can I expect to unite with others who are neither conversant about sex nor capable of knowing how to enjoy life while living? Or after death. Such foolish persons are like animals because they do not know the process of sense enjoyment in this life and after death. By the way, this is the voice of material intelligence. We'll see in a moment. Purport. By Śrīla Prabhupāda. Since there are 8,400,000 species of life, there are also many different living conditions. In the lower grades of life, plant and tree life, there's no system for sexual intercourse. In the upper grades, in the life of birds and bees, there is sex. But the insects and animals do not know how to actually enjoy sex life. In the human form of life, however, there's full knowledge of how to enjoy sex. Indeed, there are many so-called philosophers who give directions on how to enjoy sex life. There's even a science called Kama Shastra, which is the science of sex. In human life, there are also such divisions of brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. There is no sex life except in the grihastha or household or ashram. The brahmacharya is not allowed any sex, the vanaprastha voluntarily refrains from sex, and the sannyasi is completely renounced. The karmis do not practice brahmacharya, vanaprastha, or sannyas life, for they are very much interested in grihastha life. In other words, a human being is very much materially inclined. Indeed, all living entities are materially inclined. They prefer grihastha life because there is a concession for sex. The karmis think the other statuses of life are worse than animal life, for animals also have sex, whereas brahmacharya, vanaprastha, sannyasis completely give up sex. The karmis, therefore, abhor these orders of spiritual life. Interesting purport. So the context of this verse, it's coming towards the end of Canto 4. Going back to Canto 3, one of the subjects, from the process of creation, which is described in Canto 3, by Maitreya to Vidura, because he's asked about it, a very elaborate, mind-boggling, detailed description of the process of creation and sub-creation. So what Vishnu does, what Brahma does, and then once there's creation, there's need for regulation. Manu comes to give the laws of mankind, and then there's need for filling up the universe with living entities. So there are Prajapatis who, anyway, so the process of filling up the universe is presented. And all along the way, one of the first sets of Praja, or offspring from Lord Brahma, is Narada Muni. So Narada Muni is a liberated soul, and he's especially empowered, liberated soul, because not all liberated souls are empowered like he is. He's given a special potency directly by Krishna to give bhakti, the means of achieving perfection within this material world. Bhakti is that means. So he gives bhakti. He's empowered to do that. He's especially empowered. So through all that, the line of from Manu himself, then the sons of Manu and the sons of the sons of those sons and generations, they've all become perfected in life by the association of Narada, or through the association of Narada and his very expert guidance of them. So in that line, there's this one king named Prachinipari, and he kind of took a left turn when he was supposed to go right. He had inclination, as his forefathers did, to go towards the light, but he kind of went towards the darkness. He was too much interested in fruitive activities. And he was in this mood, service-wise, also of assisting the previous generations in populating this universe recently created by Lord Brahma with good offspring, good praja. So he had requested his sons, the sons of King Prachinipari from the previous chapter, we'll see that they were called Prachetas. So he said, "Can you assist me?" And they said, "Sure. This is your desire. We're sons. It's our pleasure and our duty to assist you." In that mood, they went to purify themselves, qualify themselves, because you can't do such a thing as produce good offspring unless your consciousness is pure, because the consciousness of the parent the parents, attracts a particular soul. And a qualified parents attract qualified souls to become children or offspring. So that's what they did. They went to perform some austerities to purify their consciousness. They were met before they actually commenced those austerities. They were met by Lord Shiva and with his associates, and he was very happy. He said, normally it's not very easy to see me, but I've come to show myself to you because you pleased me very much by your mood of submission to the instruction of your father. And so I'm going to give you a set of prayers, stotra, which I personally recite. And by these prayers, you will see the personality of Godhead face to face. Just as you're seeing me, you'll see the Supreme Personality of Godhead face to face. And your consciousness will become perfect. That was his benediction. He gave them the stotras. And in this narration, that description gets interrupted, which later on gets continued at the end of the fifth canto. No, not the end of the fifth canto. It carries over when they come out. It must be the fifth canto. I can't recall which canto. Maybe the end of this canto. They come out, they see Lord Vishnu, etc., etc., and then they come out of the ocean. That's in the sixth canto. So the dialogue about, the narration about the Prachetas ends, and then Narada considers the father of the Prachetas, King Prachinibari. Everyone, without exception, in the line of Swayambhuva Manu, he has delivered. So he goes to visit the palace of the king, Prachinibari. And King Prachinibari is really so very happy to have Narada come to his palace. And he receives him very nicely. And then Narada is evaluating the best approach to give bhakti to this king who's too much attached. To get back on track, he starts with asking some questions. My dear king, look in the sky and you see all those animals. Those are animals that you placed in the fire of sacrifice. Well, they're just waiting till you die, and then they're going to pierce you with iron lances. The law of karma is there, my dear king. And what do you hope to attain through these fruitive activities? And I'd like to explain to you the consequences of what you're doing by narrating to you a nice history. And the history is the history of another king. And it turns out this history is fiction. There wasn't such another king. It's allegorical. And a very important little sub-message here is, in the Bhagavatam, these are histories. The Bhagavatam is not allegory. The Bhagavatam is literal. However, there are a couple of places, this is one of them, where for instructing an historical person, King Prachinibari, Narada chooses to describe something allegorical. And the something allegorical is him, it's King Prachinibari, he's this other king, King Paranjana. And besides that particular King Prachinibari, it's any one of us. Anyone who comes into the material world seeking happiness, enjoyment through fruitive activities and sense gratification. It's the plight of the conditioned soul. as Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, when the embodied soul, soul within the body, has this expectation of happiness through contacting sense objects, misery arises. And the allegory is just expanding on that principle. Here's a living entity, here's a king. Once upon a time, there was a king named Paranjana. This is the allegorical name, King Paranjana. And he was great in this way and great in that way and great in, he lists the ways in which he's great. But he was looking for a place where he could settle his kingdom. Now, note, kings are kings of a kingdom. Commonly the law of progenitor is the son of the previous king becomes the king. So this is a little odd. This is a king looking for a kingdom. That's the living entity looking for happiness in the kingdom of God, looking to, you know, create his little kingdom. Rabindrasup calls it our God project. I need a kingdom. So he was searching high and low, this way, that way, this place, that place, traveling all over the place, looking for where he could enjoy a suitable kingdom. And then voila, he found this beautiful city and describes the details of the beautiful city, and he's going, wow, this looks like the place. And one of the things that happens is he goes into a garden within this beautiful city, and he sees this, you know, wow-looking woman. And he goes, wow. And it describes who is surrounding her, her attendants, male attendants, that have many wives, many, many wives. So it's like this whole entourage, but, you know, the centerpiece of the whole entourage is this wow-looking woman. And he approaches her, being very attracted to her, and says, in like, you know, 15 verses, wow. You're this and you're that and wow, wow, wow. Who are you? And it's helpful to understand that in order to achieve material happiness, one needs material intelligence. So we have lots of institutions in America for getting material intelligence, called schools and universities and colleges and institutes for material intelligence, because you need. And because it's allegorical, it also works, and if you know, by reading in this section, it's material nature, or it's wife, or because he's looking for he found the city, now he's looking for a queen. He's a king, he's got to have a queen. So that, because with king and queen, then there'll be sons, because it's one of the duties in the Vedic system, it's one of the duties of a king to provide a successor. Just like, you know, in the Hare Krishna movement. If you're a temple president, or if you're the head pujari, and you want to, you know, go retire in Mayapur or Vrindavan, or whatever you want to do, you can't just like walk off the altar and see you guys later. You have to find a suitable replacement so you can, your duties will not be left unattended, etc., etc., etc. So in Vedic system, the king needs a queen in part so that there can be a successor king, a son. It's part of the king's duty. So the king needs a queen. The king can't produce children out of the air. It requires a queen. So he's searching for a suitable wife, or the living entity, allegorically, the living entity is searching for the facility for fruitive activities that bring material happiness. So he needs material intelligence. He found her. You know, she's this wild lady. And the section that we're reading from is she's now responding to the question, who are you, and those kinds of things. So she's laying out who she is. She says, you know, I really don't know where I have come from, and all these other people that are with me, I don't know where they've come from, what their lineage is, who their parents are, and I just, like, they're with me, and I'm here. And she's smiling. She then describes ways in which she's attracted to him too, as he's attracted to her, and ways in which she can be of service to him. So for material intelligence, fruitive activities is really important, so that you get good results, so that you can get good objects of the senses, so that you can enjoy the objects of the senses through the medium of the senses. That's material life. You need material intelligence. So I can help you with that. Now in this, I'll just read the previous verse, because the previous verse and tomorrow's verse, there's some relationship. And so this, since this one is in between, it's good to know what the previous one has to say, and then how this connects with the next one. My dear Lord, she speaks, I have just arranged this city of nine gates for you, so that you can have all kinds of sense gratification. You may live here for 100 years. So here is the body. And material intelligence assists, you know, it's actually the mind. The mind carries desires, and the desires are detected by the super soul, both desire and deserve, karma, and bodies are provided. You may reside here for 100 years, and everything for your sense gratification will be supplied. So that the body is the field of activities, or the palace of the king. Field of activities. There's one devotee, lives somewhere, and they live on the same property as their father. So the father built their child a house on his property, kind of like a mini estate, and the father is regularly, he has a good job, but he also has like a real, he's like King Paranjan here. He regularly walks around and surveys his property and thinks of how he'll make it nice and how he'll enjoy, and then later you see him planting some trees, and later you see him pulling out some trees, and you know, it's like, he's creating his kingdom. Puts up a fence. He's always doing something to enhance his kingdom. And it's so obvious. I mean, it's not like shame on him for that. It's just, it's the nature of living entity in the material world thinking how to be the enjoyer of, you know, your domain. Kings do that. Persons do that. Children do that. They got their little whatever it is. Yes? And if somebody comes in and, you know, starts messing up their little whatever it is, they let them know. Different way. And when you have two of them with two different wills, get pretty exciting. And then mommy has to teach the lesson of, you know, share your space. Yes, Maharaj. So, then there's other, anyway, it gets complicated. Other children come in. And anyway. So this verse is specific about how material intelligence helps one to enjoy the numero uno program of material enjoyment, and it's specific about sex enjoyment. But in the previous purport, I'm going to read that. There's the religious sense of material enjoyment, dharma, artha, kama, moksha. Those of you that attended the program yesterday evening, you remember this description of desire trees, kalpa vriksha trees, in the Goloka Vrindavan. And Bhaktisiddhanta's comment is that the Vedas are like a desire tree which can fulfill all desires. Through dharma, one gets artha. Through religious activity, one gets piety, and with that, prosperity. And with that prosperity, one can then get kama, or sense enjoyment. So through the Vedas, one can fulfill one's desires. So that's the better intelligence than the university type. People have a different sense of priorities, but that's the better intelligence, Vedic intelligence. The Veda means knowledge. So it's knowledge of how to use this machine, the material, the body, in such a way desires are fulfilled. Better intelligence than that material intelligence. But it's still in this realm of material. And allegorically, the woman that King Puranjan just met, that's her. She's ready to give that knowledge. And so Prabhupada speaks of, in this system of religiosity that yields prosperity, that yields sense enjoyment, and, oh, by the way, eventually maybe liberation too, the wife in that setup, in that system of religiosity, prosperity, sense enjoyment, the wife has a very specific role. And that's the previous verse. So she's saying, I can assist you in these things. That's material intelligence. Religious material intelligence. That's what King Pachini Bari is into. The person who's being told the allegory is he's too much attached to that. The fruit of activities within the Vedas to get piety, to get prosperity, to get sense enjoyment. So Narada is giving this allegory of this other king over there who, through the agency of the one who will become his queen, this material intelligence person, this wild lady, she can then help you. So he becomes very attached to her. And she's making her expressions of how she can help him, serve him very nicely in the affairs of religious activity. So he can prosper and he can enjoy. And then, now this verse is similarly within the field of material enjoyment, there's the number one attraction since time immemorial. And that's male-female attraction. The sex attraction. So she's saying in the verse, animals, the lower species, they don't understand. They don't even have sex life. And the lower, the plants and trees, the insects, bees, birds, animals, they have sex, but they don't really understand. There's this, you know, real enjoyment program in sex life that these other people, they're missing out. And so within the purport, Prabhupada is speaking about that, you know, in non-religious society, there's all these literatures about how to enjoy sex. It helps it sell magazines and books and things. People just write about that and people buy them because they're interested in the material intelligence feature. Then there's even within the scripture, there's kama, as indicated, kama shastra, how to maximally enjoy the facility of embodiment in terms of sex life. Then what Prabhupada writes is in this Vedic model, there's only one ashram, that there's concession. Brahmachari, no concession. Vanaprastha, no concession. Sannyas, no concession. Grihastha, concession. Of course, go down from the Vedic system and then you just live like an animal and no regulation at all. Unfortunately. So, because of that no regulation at all, there's no sense at all of the mission of life, the real identity of the soul within the body, and the purpose of the soul having a human form of life. So if humans live their lives in that way, they're not only no better than an animal, they're worse. Because there are consequences for a human being that lives their life that way, and there's not the same karmic consequences for an animal that lives their life like an animal. But if humans live their life like an animal, there's very severe consequences, unfortunately. As Prabhupada is writing, the persons not only some persons are attracted to being enjoyers of matter, like this King Paranjana. All living entities in the material world take birth because they're interested in separate enjoyment, and the whole separate enjoyment program is you get a body and there's matter and go. Try to enjoy matter. So in the different ways that different people try to enjoy matter produces karma and produces then further embodiments in the whole entanglement of material existence. So all living entities in this created realm have this material attraction. The Vedic wisdom is not meant for getting a higher grade. She's the advocating the higher grade program. Do it smarter. Do it better. Have more enjoyment. Have a qualitative upgrade in your enjoyment program. That's material intelligence. And people that have put together the propensity to enjoy with material intelligence, and zoom, zoom, down the road you go, heading for a crash. Because human form of life is not meant for that. Now, King Prachinibari, the person who's receiving this allegory, Narada's evaluation is that he's not ready to hear that. He's not ready to hear transcendental knowledge. So he's indirectly preparing him for the collision. So that he can let go of the material enjoyment program portion of the Vedas. There is a large portion of the Vedas that deals with that. So he can come to the bhakti portion of the Vedas. It's really brilliant. And it's a compliment to King Prachinibari, that, well, it's a gentler form than what happened with, in the sixth canto with King Chitraketu. King Chitraketu, in the sixth canto, was also a became perfect being through the agency of Narada's association. And Narada's very good friend Angira Muni. So you don't get too confused by too many stories here. I'm just illustrating a principle. King Prachinibari was able to understand by hearing. It took a while. It took this allegory. It's a long, it's like a really long section of the Bhagavatam. I mean, practically this much of the Bhagavatam is the allegory. That, and then Narada explains the allegory. That king, Paranjana, that's you. Or a living entity that wants to separately enjoy. That's, and the lady, that's material intelligence. And the kingdom, that's this body. And this, and the serpent, that's prana, the life air. And then the attendants, they're the guards of the senses and so forth. You know, the whole allegory is just describing the nature of material life. And there's consequences for material life. And that's all within the allegory. King Prachinibari, my point is, that King Prachinibari was able to, just hearing an allegory, he could get it. Whereas King Chitraketu, Angira, decided he can't get it. He can't receive knowledge just by hearing. He has to have, like, this, you know, a calamity, some horrific, traumatic experience, turn him upside down and bang him on the head experience. And then he'll be able to hear. So it's important that we observe how Narada does what he does. He evaluates the audience, the hearer, or the person he wishes to give bhakti to, and according to the capacity and the position of the person, he'll give this way or that way or another way. So in the course of the Bhagavatam, we're getting, I think it'd be a nice project to see, you know, how, what are the, you know, the different ways in which Narada does what he does. So then we can have, like, okay, here's a menu, which is the best approach in this circumstance. And it may not even be on the menu, but, you know, so we can think a little creatively rather than, you know, we have the Srimad Bhagavatam in one hand and a stick in the other hand. You know, that's a very limited approach. He doesn't do that with King Prachinibari. He described his whole allegory. And if we pay too much attention to the material intelligence, it may keep us away from devotion to Krishna. Because it will say, well, you're gonna lose enjoyment. And if you lose enjoyment, you know, what is there to life? Because after all, you want to be happy. And if you lose enjoyment, what are you doing? You know, that counsel of the material intelligence may be a deterrent for some people. But exactly what he's saying in the purport, well, you know, grihastha life, okay. But you know, this brahmachari, you know, you people are fanatics, brahmachari, anaprastha sannyas. But even, you know, even grihastha life executed properly has its brake pedal too. It's not certainly unrestricted association between husband and wife, particularly in the sexual activity department. It's a whole other, you know, for the purpose of elevation, not for the purpose of recreation. And for the purpose of taking a soul from the conditioned life to the liberated life. It's that kind of service unto Krishna. And there's a method or an approach or a system, the science of how to do that. And that's the greater happiness. But persons who don't understand the goal of life, because they're too attached to the bodily conception and the happiness that goes with material intelligence, helping us to get material happiness in the bodily conception, they won't be able to relate to it. So therefore, this creative approach by Narada, and then also, therefore, within the Vedas, there are other provisions for people who aren't ready to just surrender to Krishna. I've had like 3 questions, almost the same, asked in the past 10 days about this. You know, why would Krishna give these other things? And then because people think, well, there's the other things. Well, you know, like one person was saying, why not only Krishna? Why not only Krishna worship? Well, for the reason that people are in the material world, they don't want to surrender to Krishna. So if you have only one option, which they've already rejected, Krishna worship, they don't want to surrender to Krishna, where's the safety net? What's going to lift them up? Knowing the aversion to Krishna principle that brings people to the material world, there's others. There's other, within the Vedic literature, there's other things that are to help one to gradually come to the preparedness to surrender to Krishna again. Here, Narada is like, Lakshmi Moni was using this term, accelerated learning. He's like, you know, speeding up the process of transmitting bhakti before just letting, you know, the gradual, lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. He's very compassionate, so he accelerates the process. But he's very thoughtful in how to best give the bhakti principle to people. In this case, the king, Prachinibari. And he's choosing to do by way of allegory. And tomorrow we're going to hear some more about the Dharma Artha Kama principles that material intelligence can help one with. Any discussion? A little complicated. Yeah.
Ramaji, in Narada's case, in many of his examples of creativity giving Krishna consciousness, there seems to be a commonality of the recipient having respect for Srinagar.
Yeah.
And that component is something we have to work with up in today's day and age.
Right. Well, it's not, it's something that has to be it has to be established. And there are ways to establish it. But it's the challenge that Prabhupada faced when he came to the West. And he, being, you know, an empowered, super empowered personality, he accomplished that. We, not being super empowered personalities, yes, there's that requirement. Extra. Those who have, it's like one of the advantages of Vedic culture in general is it underlying principle is respect for authority. It's just part of the culture. I mean, 2 examples. When Indian students have come to America to study, one of the things that they've shared with me is the disrespect towards the professor in the classroom is shocking. And, you know, we would never, never, never. But, you know, here in the West, it's It's not just like an even playing field, it's disrespect. It's just shocking. Then another is, I was unaware of this principle because I grew up in America. I was one time walking through the hallway, the Brooklyn Temple, and there was a devotee sitting at the reception desk talking to another devotee or two, and just by walking by, he stood up. And it didn't require a discussion, I could understand. It's just, he stopped what he was doing and stood up. Because in America, the only place where I've seen that is in a courtroom. Judge walks in, you stand up. If you don't stand up, you're in jail. You respect the judge. It's law. Everyone rise. Here comes the judge. Because he's going to have to, you know, disappoint somebody in the courtroom. His job is not to, you know, pacify everybody in the courtroom. His job is to, anyway, see what's right and then enunciate according to the law. And one who has that position needs to be shown respect. And similarly, a teacher of bhakti has a very weighty task to do, and it won't be received if there isn't respect. The first canto is there's five or six different scenarios in which that principle of receiving bhakti from a qualified person it's shown again and again. It's specific, it's enunciated again and again. Respect is necessary towards the person who is giving. And yes, go back to your question. That's not a given in the Western culture. The opposite is a given. Challenge. And not even, you know, a qualified challenge, like do it in a civilized way. Challenge. Authority. Therefore, those who are presenting Krishna consciousness to others are that one of the first responsibilities is to establish a relationship where, first of all, that you're worthy of others' trust and respect, and then in the course of trustworthy dealings, then someone can feel towards the preacher or the giver of Krishna consciousness. They can feel towards that person some trust and some respect. A lot of that has to do with the qualities that we carry and the care and concern and compassion genuine for the person. Not like just like the mission, go rescue them, but the actually caring about the person. Anyway, yes, it is. It's not a given. Mine is Vedic culture. And within Vedic culture, it's a given. That's a major topic. It's not a short topic. A lot depends on the individual, and a lot depends on what happens in the relationship between parents and their child before that. You know, what kind of relationship exists? You know, is there a trusting, open, confidence, disclosing, honoring that confidentiality, non-judgmentalism, and all of those things. And, you know, what was true When you were growing up, and when your parents were growing up as children, there are different, maybe a different set of rules because of the conditioning and, you know, the degradation of culture, pervasive. But, so it depends on so many things. And, you know, the wholesomeness of the association, so many things. Just, you know, a few things that come to mind is an approach, three things. An approach where the parent becomes, this is Prabhupada's instruction, becomes more like a friend than an authority. And that has a whole package that goes with being a friend instead of an authority. Because you're still an authority. Parent is still the parent. But the demeanor in which that role of being the authority parent is executed needs to be consciously modified to a friend. And a friend is just, you know, a friend shares with a friend. And the other friend doesn't say, "What?" You know, judgmentalism. "You did this, said that." You know, the openness is going to disappear. So it's just, "Oh, really? You know, what did you think about that? And what did you feel about that?" And I call it, you know, there's just dialogue through questions. And guiding can be through question, but not like... Another is a role model. Someone to emulate. Another is peer association. And somehow, by Krishna's arrangement, having quality peer association. So because friendship, and friendship that's, you know, peer association, someone that's has imbibed by their own choice a value system that's wholesome, rather than, you know, the abundant alternatives out there that are not wholesome. So a wholesome association, friend, and, you know, a kind of, I don't know, is this a fourth item, which is someone who can assist in a mentor model for someone in of that age. It's helpful. Because, you know, the parent daughter or son, parent child relationship, there's this familiarity. And then it makes it really easy where there's familiarity to have contempt. Even there may be affection to, like, when some, you know, some good intended suggestion or consideration or even constraint is provided, just because of that familiarity, it may be, you know, may more easily be received by someone who's a mentor. It has to be, you know, the right person who is trustworthy and confidential and, you know, shares the views of the parent and or supports the views of the parent but is not the parent. It's helpful. My fifth thing is just having, like, this such attractive, inviting relationships and spiritual atmosphere in the home that it's conducive to the spiritual choice as opposed to the other one. You know, parenting is a challenge. Turn it around and being a teenager is a challenge. Yikes. Something else? Yes?
Sometimes just difficult to distinguish between the material, between the material mind and the material intelligence. Like the mind also tries to make plans. So how do we distinguish, is the mind or the intelligence that's trying to?
I could say some things, but I'll preface those things by saying, whether it's the material mind or material intelligence, it's an academic exercise, because material and material. The real issue is not whether it's the mind or the intelligence, the real issue is whether Krishna is in the picture or not. Because a very simple definition of material is forgetfulness of Krishna. And simple definition of spiritual is remembrance of Krishna. So if we just achieve remembrance of Krishna, then the functions of the mind and the functions of the intelligence are properly ordered. But yes, plan making is a function of the mind. But the mind takes assistance from the intelligence. So they're a team. And it is sometimes difficult to discern who's who, what's going on here. But it is really easy to discern, is Krishna in the picture, genuinely, like finding the happiness of Krishna, coming closer to Krishna, like that. If that principle or driving force is behind, then the mind and the intelligence start to act in a spiritual way. One will decide what to do, what not to do, based on what is pleasing to Krishna, not what is going to enhance my independent enjoyment. Okay, thank you very much. Prabhupada ki jai.